This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega, and it's great to be with you on this Monday. The second impeachment trial of former President Donald Trump, now a private citizen, is scheduled to begin next week in the Senate. But just weeks ago, there were signs that impeachment could be a bipartisan issue after a number of prominent Republicans criticized the former president for his role in inciting the Capitol insurrection.
The mob was fed lies. They were provoked by the president and other powerful people.
The president bears responsibility for Wednesday's attack on Congress by mob rioters. He should have immediately denounced the mob when he saw what was unfolding.
I hate it being this way. Oh my God, I hate it. All I can say is count me out. Enough is enough. I've tried to be helpful. When it's over, it is over. It is over.
But now, most GOP members are delivering a very different message.
Here's what I'd like. I'd like to get this trial over sooner rather than later. To my Democratic colleagues, if you try to call one witness, you're going to blow up the United States Senate. Don't do that.
Hyperpartisan Democrats are about to drag our great country down into the gutter of rancor and vitriol, the likes of which has never been seen in our nation's history.
But I want everybody to take a deep breath and understand we all have some responsibility here.
That was House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy, who met with Trump last week. Last week, all but five Senate Republicans attempted to block the impeachment trial from moving forward, voting against it as unconstitutional now that Trump is a private citizen. So with most congressional Republicans shifting into their roles as members of the opposition party and looking ahead instead to the 2022 midterms, a reckoning within the GOP over the Capitol riots doesn't appear to be coming. Understanding why the Republican Party is sticking with Donald Trump in his post-presidential days is where we start today. And let's get going with Doug High, who's led communication positions in the House, Senate, RNC, and served in the George W. Bush administration. Doug, thanks for coming back on the show.
It's good to be with you. Thank you.
Also is Sahil Kapoor, national political reporter for NBC News. Sahil, welcome.
Great to be back.
Doug, I'm having whiplash listening to those statements from top GOP officials here. What, why is accountability for what happened at the Capitol considered something that's tearing the country apart right now? How did we go from wanting to hold the president accountable to this?
Well, I think it comes down to a word called politics. And, you know, when you talk about accountability, the one thing that House Republicans, Senate Republicans, too, have been very mindful of over the past 4 years is that they face an accountability from their voters. And their voters are overwhelmingly supportive of Donald Trump. Again, that's especially more true in the House than in the Senate, where you have, you know, congressional lines that are drawn in a more partisan way. And that's what they're reacting to, because that's who they're hearing from most vocally. I can tell you my conversations with members of Congress on the feedback that they get from their voters is overwhelmingly pro-Trump. And, you know, one thing that we know about Trump supporters, they're not quiet. It's not a silent majority or silent minority for that matter. They are loud and vocal. That's what they're hearing from, and that's what they're reacting to.
So, Doug, really, I mean, these voters or support Trump supporters are sort of intimidating their representatives into what? Into believing that this didn't happen? Into believing that the former president has no accountability for this?
Well, they're pushing them to not convict him or not impeach him if the vote's in the House. And that, again, is what they're reacting to. And part of this is you mentioned in the setup for the 2022 elections. I can tell you a big part of why House leadership did not vote to impeach the president, House Republican leadership, despite the words of Kevin McCarthy, despite the private misgivings of Steve Scalise, is because they want Donald Trump's support in 2022. Taking back the House is their biggest priority. And if Donald Trump is not on board, they see him as a real impediment to that, because he would potentially, you know, go in and cause trouble in House Republican primaries and then even in general elections where he wouldn't be supportive. That's a big concern for them.
Sahil, I want to bring you in here because I'm wondering, we heard different clips from GOP leadership immediately following the Capitol insurrection. We heard from McCarthy, Mitch McConnell, Lindsey Graham. And were they just shell-shocked by what had just happened and hadn't had a chance to process the political calculations that they were going to have to make? I mean, trying to explain this sort of shift here.
I think many Republicans, including party leaders, were legitimately rattled by what happened on January 6th. It was extremely, extremely unusual for them to be in a situation where in the building they work in the United States Capitol, their safety and their lives were put at risk. So this was an extraordinary event. And I think that did play into some of the early Republican reactions criticizing President Trump as a result of this. It certainly played into the fact that 10 House Republicans voted to impeach former President Trump, making that the most bipartisan impeachment in history. But over time, politics has a way of regressing to the mean. And the sentiment, as Doug was pointing out, that these lawmakers heard from their Republican voters was overwhelmingly pro-Trump. And that's why you saw a little bit of vacillating early on from the orbit of Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell, who was reportedly pleased to see impeachment go forward. He seems to have walked a lot of that back, and now he is signaling, along with 90% of Senate Republicans, that they intend to oppose the impeachment trial on a technical ground, and by all indications, appear likely to acquit the president.
So, Sahil, if there is no, I guess we shouldn't get ahead of ourselves here, but if the chances of Trump being convicted here are very low, why are Democrats moving forward with the trial?
Well, they have to have the trial now. It's a little too late not to, given that the House has impeached the president and the House managers have walked the papers over to the Senate. There's not much else that can happen except a Senate trial. The reason Democrats did this was not necessarily out of politics. I think politics had little to do with this. I think this was out of conviction. There were Democratic members who believed that doing impeachment at this time would distract and detract on the Senate floor from President Biden's agenda, from his cabinet nominees, from getting his legislative proposals off the ground. And that was a legitimate concern. But that argument lost out to the overwhelming sentiment of House Democrats that if the House won't impeach a president for this, for inciting an insurrection on the U.S. Capitol, putting the safety and lives of lawmakers and everyone in the building at risk, then what is the point of impeachment? What is the point of having a constitution if a president can aim a dagger at the heart of a legitimate self-government and a legitimate election, and Congress does nothing about it? So this was more about conviction than politics.
I think we definitely need to ask that question, Doug. I mean, if the Republican Party, I want to get into some of the folks who voted for impeaching the former president in just a minute, but if the party, as Sahil is pointing out, doesn't hold Donald Trump accountable or any of the GOP accountable for this, what does that mean?
Well, it means again that this is a process that's about politics, and Republicans are very mindful again of what they're hearing from their constituents. They're also mindful of what they're hearing from their other members. And so, if you look at the backlash that Liz Cheney has gotten for sticking her neck out and doing what she thought was the right thing, doing so as a member of House leadership. The only member of House leadership to support impeachment, she's being campaigned against already in her district in Wyoming. I can tell you, I had a Wyoming politician call me saying, I'm being recruited to run. And this was 2 days after the vote. That wouldn't have happened if Liz Cheney voted the other way. Members are very mindful of the politics of this. I would equate them sometimes to, animals that start to scurry before anybody else sees the earthquake coming. But that's the reality of where they are right now.
And Doug, 10 House Republicans did vote to impeach former President Donald Trump. What's their calculus there?
It's hard to say. Politically, I think they know that it's not a popular move. We just talked about Liz Cheney. Tom Rice in South Carolina has been censured by his own state party. And we're seeing other state parties censure Republicans who voted to impeach as well. Not that every member of Congress is necessarily worried about what the Oregon Republican Party is doing, but it demonstrates the sense of what is out there in the party right now, and that the politics of this are especially treacherous for those Republicans. I would say there's a flip side to that politically as well. I'm looking at my home state of North Carolina, where 5,800 Republicans in this month of January, since January 6th, have changed their registration from Republican to unaffiliated. So the state party's losing voters. And if you're motivated to leave your state party to do something political in January of an off year, that means you're really motivated and you're really angry. It's unfortunately a lesson that Republicans may only learn come next November, not in their primaries. It may intensify kind of that Trump problem that they face.
Sahil, in the days after the Capitol insurrection, the RNC reelected chairwoman, Ronna McDaniel, who's a Trump ally. What does that say about how much, I guess it underscores this point that the GOP is really leaning in to Trump and Trumpism.
Yes, it's still very much Donald Trump's party. We saw that when House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy a few days ago went to visit him in Florida, released a photo of him with the former president, talked about how Trump has committed to helping Republicans win the House majority, which, again, as Doug pointed out, is the overriding priority of much of what happens here. There's a separate controversy involving a congresswoman who has said a lot of inflammatory and conspiratorial things named Marjorie Taylor Greene, who is also invoking former President Trump as a supporter of hers and saying, essentially signaling to leadership that don't you dare cross me because I have the support of Donald Trump. He is still the kingmaker in the party. He no longer has the bully pulpit in the White House. He no longer has his Twitter feed, which is his preferred mode of communication, but he still looms large over the party. The voters still have a passionate kind of connection to him. And I want to make one little point on your earlier question. Why did those 10 House Republicans vote to impeach the president? One of the reasons is all 10 of them ran ahead of President Trump in their district. So they feel insulated to an extent. And they also believe that they have independent brands that can kind of help them at home.
Doug, we're talking about how frightened, I guess, is one word to say, a lot of the GOP are for their holding on to their political positions, afraid to turn away from constituents who are bathed in the glory of their former president here and refuse to let go of that. My question to you, Doug, is why don't these folks leave government and go make money in the private sector? Like, why are they holding on so tightly to this ideology, which is, in fact, appearing to tear the country apart?
You know, it's a very good question. I actually asked a pretty similar question of that to a member I've known for a long, long time who voted against impeachment and said, basically, you know, why is this worth being ranking member of a subcommittee or, if you get back the majority, chair of a subcommittee? Like, the members of Congress aren't very happy. Capitol Hill is not a really great workplace, I'd tell you. You know, my experiences there, I had a great boss, but it was miserable because we were going through things like shutdowns and constant fighting with your own team to where you didn't have time to worry about fighting with Nancy Pelosi because you had to shore up your own side constantly. And that member of Congress was Eric Cantor. And, you know, he's a cautionary tale for a lot of these Republicans who are scared of, if they do what they see as the right thing, that they're going to lose. And I would tell you, the fact that Eric Cantor wanted to do something on immigration was a contributing factor to his loss. And it's why immigration reform never happened in Congress, you know, since then in 2014. That's been 6+ years now.
Sahil, how do we explain that? I mean, the idea that there are members of Congress in the GOP who are, you know, choosing to stay in these roles, choosing to stay in this position, when they could easily, you know, go into the private sector or into consulting and make a number of different career moves that wouldn't have them, you know, essentially in fear of a political party or of certain constituents.
Look at who is retiring and who has retired in recent years. People in the House Republican Conference who are known to be workhorses, who are known to be interested in getting things done, many of them have left. Greg Walden is one example, the former chairman of the Energy and Commerce Committee. Other figures like Pat Tiberi have retired. previously a close ally to the former speaker, John Boehner, understood as, you know, someone who's respected in the conference. There are a lot of people who were there to get things done, who were policy minded, who have decided to leave. Not all of them, but many of them. And this moment in politics is a very good time for show horses, you know, who want to spend a lot of time on right wing media and maybe boost their personal profile and collect social media followers. This is a very good time for them because that's kind of the political moment that they're in right now. But for those who are more policy minded, who are more interested in getting things done through the hard work of compromise, this is a pretty dark political moment.
Sahil, I'm wondering also, there are rumblings, I don't know how real they are right now, that there could be, and we've heard this many times in our political past, that there could be the emergence of a third party here. Are you hearing anything like that? Is it still too early to even think about that?
I think rumblings is fair, mainly because they're emanating from former President Trump. But my view on this is I'm highly skeptical because there's always some talk of a third party or the potential for a third party, given that the two major parties are so unpopular. But there are many reasons it doesn't happen. The single biggest one is negative partisanship. Voters dislike one party strongly enough to vote for their opposition, and having two major parties only entrenches that trend. But the one caveat to this is Donald Trump. And if he were to decide that he wants to fully throw his support behind a third party, they seem to be testing out potential names for that. If he decides he wants to do that, then I think the Republicans are in a world of trouble because he will take a big chunk of that party's base with him. And it's unclear how much of a future Republicans would have then. And frankly, I think that's one of the major reasons you see party leaders and lawmakers and operatives eager not to alienate him. And one of the reasons that he is on track at this point to being acquitted. If he were to be significantly and sharply disowned by the Republican Party, that would only raise his odds of wanting to start a third party.
Doug, we're not just talking about the political calculus that a lot of lawmakers are making, but there is this really happened. The Capitol insurrection happened live on national television on January 6th in the afternoon. Americans and people across the country and a world were watching what was happening. If there is a failure to convict the president for any role in this, does that, Doug, further embolden some of the radical groups that we saw involved in that Capitol insurrection, who the FBI and the CIA are already saying are a serious problem to our national security?
Yeah, to be honest, I don't know the answer to that. And that's because, you know, one thing that a lot of Republicans have said is that going through a second impeachment process is divisive. I agree it's divisive. Now,
I just got to push back on that. How is it divisive,
If I can finish, I think it's a necessary division. You know, we have to show that there are real punishments when you do something wrong. I'm not a parent, but every parent that I know doesn't not punish their child for doing something wrong because the kid's not going to like the punishment. But we need to be mindful that it's very clear that there could be a further adverse reaction to this. It's part of why the Capitol is still under, a total lockdown, and you still have National Guards members, you know, patrolling that perimeter. So I think it's unclear which is going to cause bigger, you know, a bigger problem, you know, with that Trump base. If people are going to break the law, they need to be put in jail. There's no question about that. The impeachment process is entirely political. It's not a legal process. It wasn't designed to be. I worry that, you know, without a conviction, we also send a message to any future president that as long as you do something in your closing days, you know, to pick an idea that's not, you know, hypothetical anymore, shooting somebody on Fifth Avenue, that you can do that as long as you do it late enough. That's a terrible signal to send.
We got to be watching very closely. Doug High is a communications expert who's had positions in the House, Senate, RNC, and the George W. Bush administration. And Sahil Kapoor is a national political reporter for NBC News. Thanks to you both for being with us.
Good to join you.
January has been the deadliest month of the COVID-19 pandemic in the United States so far. Nearly 80,000 people died over the past few weeks, bringing the country's total death toll to more than 425,000. That incalculable loss has left so many families grieving. And on top of that grief, it's left families struggling to cover the costs associated with those deaths, too, namely burials and cremations. But relief could be on the way for some families, with federal funding for COVID-19 funeral costs being allocated in the December stimulus package that was passed by Congress. For more on that, I'm joined by Tanya Marsh, a professor at Wake Forest School of Law and host of Death at SEC podcast, a podcast about death care and the laws around it. Tanya, thanks for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me.
One of the things that I don't think is top of mind for a lot of people when they lose a family member or loved one is how much it's going to cost. What's the average cost of dying in the United States today?
Well, that's a really good question. We know that what it was pre-COVID was about $8,500. But of course, that varies significantly from place to place. In a market like New York City, it's going to be understandably more expensive than it would be in a smaller community elsewhere in the United States. Then on top of that $8,500, you have the cost of any burial. So that would include the cost of the grave itself, opening and closing the grave with service charges that are incurred at the time of need. So you can easily be over $10,000.
I've heard that figure, the $10,000 figure, a lot. And that seems to be regardless of the type of funeral home. You know, that's even at the lower levels I'm hearing from friends and family. Tanya, why are funeral costs so expensive?
Well, there's a lot of goods and services that go into those funeral costs. So you're getting the services of a funeral director, and they do an awful lot of things behind the scenes that grieving people don't want to deal with or can't deal with, or it's legally, logistically difficult for them to deal with. So mundane things like getting the death certificate submitted and dealing with the paperwork with the state, getting something called a burial transit permit, which is necessary for final disposition. They also deal with coming and taking the body from the place where death occurred and cleaning it up and making it presentable in a way that is socially acceptable for us, I suppose, to let our deceased loved ones go.
The federal government has been involved in this in some ways. Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez co-introduced a bill back in spring 2020 to provide financial assistance for funeral expenses. That bill itself is stalled, but she and other members of Congress were able to get some financial relief into the stimulus package that we mentioned at the top was approved at the end of 2020. Tanya, what is in that package that will help grieving families?
Right. So in the December 2020 stimulus package, there was $2 billion allocated for FEMA to distribute as funeral assistance as part of their sort of typical way that they disperse money for disaster assistance. And so FEMA is actually in the process of the rulemaking for that. So there's a lot that we don't know about how that money will be allocated. We do know that the FEMA spokesperson has said that it will only be available for funeral expenses that were incurred prior to December 31st of last year. I don't know if with respect to funerals that take place in 2021, whether or not that would require additional funding or if that's something that FEMA has the authority to do under that prior bill.
Does it look like there's a lot of red tape for families right now who are looking to get some of those resources?
Well, if you look at historically the disaster funeral assistance rules that FEMA has adopted, there's not a ton of red tape. This is a different kind of disaster, right? So the documentation, I suppose, that would be required is going to be less difficult for people to obtain for deaths due to COVID than, say, a hurricane or other natural disaster, which may have, you know, wiped away people's homes and made documentation really difficult to get. I will say that one of the potential hangups is that, in general, the FEMA Disaster Funeral Assistance Program will only pay families for unmet funeral needs. So that is that they're not being covered by veterans assistance benefits, Social Security, or even personal income and savings. So I know that the folks who proposed this to Congress keep referring to it as a reimbursement, but that's not typically how the FEMA Disaster Funeral Assistance Program works. So whether or not they're going to change it for COVID-related deaths remains to be seen.
Tanya, you mentioned FEMA assistance in the past. What about something called the Stafford Act? What is that?
Well, the Stafford Act is basically enabling legislation that defines sort of the limits of FEMA assistance and talks about some of the programs that they can engage in. So the Stafford Act doesn't really say anything particular about funeral assistance and what character that might take. It gives FEMA the flexibility to set up programs that are responsive to a particular disaster.
We've been talking about the financial hardship that some families will face when trying to really bury their loved ones and have end-of-life celebrations for them, because that can be very costly. But there's another side to this, which are the funeral directors, the people who work in funeral homes, who themselves have been overwhelmed with demand. Some going so far as to, you know, do things that may not be appropriate, you know, say, storing bodies that they don't have the capacity to store because they just feel overwhelmed and want to do what they can. Is there any relief for them?
Well, I suppose that this $2 billion, if it's all spent on funeral expenses, will be going to the funeral directors, right? But I think part of the unevenness of this as a response to their need is that I know anecdotally a lot of funeral directors simply knocked down the cost, right? When faced with families who had financial need, even though funeral directors have experienced increased costs themselves, some have had to go as far as get refrigerated trucks, et cetera, to sit outside. And then, of course, the PPE and other sorts of protection for themselves from a virus that continues to be communicable after death. If FEMA is going to follow the same playbook that they have in the past, that's not going to really be able to compensate funeral directors fully for their cost to the extent that they wrote off some of those costs because families were struggling in 2020.
Tanya, is this a moment to rethink the funeral industry moving forward?
Oh, I think that we need to fundamentally rethink a great deal about the relationship between the government and what is essentially a privatized system for handling and disposing of the dead. We have a private funeral industry, we have a private cemetery industry, and then, of course, more than half of Americans are cremated. Now that is also entirely privatized. So one thing that I think we've really seen in New York City and we've seen in Los Angeles in recent weeks is how rigid the system is. So the private market, when it is subject to a great deal of regulation, whether that regulation is reasonable or not, cannot nimbly respond to great increases in demand. And we have a very static, rigid system. So if the government isn't going to be able to step in and help out in these sorts of situations, and so far it hasn't, then I think we do need to look at ways to make the private industry able to respond better.
Tanya Marsh is a professor at Wake Forest School of Law and host of Death at SEC, a podcast about death care in the United States. Tanya, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. This past summer, Americans watched as an uprising for racial justice made its way across the United States. As that remarkable historical moment unfolded, The Takeaway spoke to history teachers to ask them how they explained that moment to their students.
The place that we started in my classroom was just for what I needed to do, we needed to start with just dispelling myths.
But now history teachers are grappling with how to teach another historic moment, the Capitol insurrection, and one of the most tumultuous transfers of power we've ever seen. Here's what one teacher had to say.
My name is Niles Mateer, but my students call me Mr. M. And I teach fifth grade U.S. history at Boston Collegiate Charter School in Boston, Massachusetts. As a history teacher, I do want my students to feel hopeful for the future of the country. However, I also want students to know that while they may love this country, in order for it to improve, we must never stop critiquing it.
We've also got one of the teachers we spoke to back in July with us. Matt Bockenfeld is a social studies teacher at Fishers High School in Fishers, Indiana. Matt, welcome back.
Thanks so much for having me back, Tanzina.
Also, we have some new perspective from Brenton Cobb, a sixth grade history teacher and math teacher in Fort Worth, Texas. Brenton, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me on, too.
Brenton, let's start with you. Has teaching online and in person sort of prevented you from having in-depth conversations about what's going on? Are students sort of approaching you with, hey, what's happening?
That's a good question. I think that with, because I'm teaching in person and online at the same time, it does have a barrier with students online at times. And I mean, I feel like in the classroom, it's a lot easier to have those conversations, but engaging with students online, there is still a barrier. And I think that it does cause some problems to have those deep conversations sometimes. I think also there's a disconnect too when you're online from your students. You're more, when you're in person, you know those people. And I think that there's a lot of anxiety for these students during this time. And I think that also takes away from, you know, just learning in general.
So. I want to ask you a little bit, Brenton, in a moment, just about what kinds of questions your sixth graders are coming to you with. But Matt, what about you? You teach high school. What are your high schoolers coming to you with? Does it matter if you're remote or in person, or did they have lots of questions for you right off the bat?
Yeah, well, I mean, listen, I mean, there's never been a better time to be a teacher or a harder time to be a teacher, because I think the pandemic has kind of magnified every imaginable social issue. And so kids, I mean, the questions have been absolutely nonstop. And I kind of share the it's incredibly difficult what Brenton was describing, kind of creating that safe space to have the environment, to have sort of the honesty and the vulnerability to talk about politics, to talk about race. To talk about, honestly, to talk about death as the kind of the pandemic kind of drums on in the background. And so it's been incredibly challenging and very rewarding working at kind of building a classroom space that is both online and in person at the same moment, and where you are still having those conversations, because the kids have never had more questions than they do right now.
I'm going to come back to you, Matt, about what kinds of questions they have. Brenton, what are the sixth graders that you teach? What do they want to know about what's happening? Are they scared? Are they confused? Are they excited? What are they coming to you with?
A lot of them are nervous or scared or don't actually know what's going on, because there's so much disinformation out there. And so I've had a lot of students, like when the insurrection happened, a lot of the students were like, are we going to go to war? And even when Trump lost in November, a lot of the students came up to me and they were just like, you know, if he loses, are we going to war tomorrow? Like, what's going to happen? And a lot of them were just really concerned. I think that a lot of them didn't understand certain things too, which also promoted a lot of more questions from me. And I felt like for sixth graders, like all the information that they're getting is from their parents too, and they don't really know much besides that. Like these students, a lot of them don't like search the web or anything like that, or they don't really, at this moment in time, they're just learning about credible sources. So it's me more like trying to find those credible sources for them and talking about that too. So it's been quite interesting and teaching right now.
Matt, that's a really important point, because I often say we are in the misinformation wars as we speak. And so for high school students that you're teaching, are they coming to you with similar questions, or have they done their own research, or are you also grappling with the effects of misinformation in the classroom?
Yeah, I mean, undoubtedly. I teach in an interesting context. We're a suburban school just outside of a city, very rapidly diversifying. But, you know, within my building, we have students who are sympathetic to the Proud Boys, or even have said that they plan to join the Proud Boys. And we also have, you know, undocumented folks just kind of trying to make it in America. You know, we have sort of this broad swath of society that we have to serve all of those students. And so, you know, we have students that walk in and they ask, like, is this a fascist takeover? We have students asking, are the police going to be abolished? Students asking, what is white supremacy? And so we're kind of hosting all those conversations within the context of a very, very divided city, politically and, you know, in every way you can imagine. It's just hyper polarized.
Is that polarization, Matt, showing up among students?
So I think it's showing up in the classroom because we are kind of trapped with students who they hear what they hear from home, And they, you know, I guess what we say in the classroom is that post-truth is pre-fascism. So what we have to do is tell the truth all the time and hold to human dignity, regardless of people's perspectives. And so when we sort of set that context, our conversations are, I think, much more productive than they would be otherwise.
Brenton, when we think about things like fascism, white supremacy, these are not new ideas, but they also aren't pillars of a lot of American history classes to begin with, especially in the sixth grade. How do you introduce these topics?
Well, I try to relate it. Like the other day, we talked about Hitler, we talked about Germany, and they have a little context behind that. So I try to bring that into like kind of like taking their background knowledge into what's going on today. And is this like fascism, or are we seeing something that could result in like something as a fascist takeover? And I think a lot of the students were really nervous about that, but it also sprung up more conversation amongst them, trying to kind of get their ideas going. And I thought that was really great, like trying to relate that on their background knowledge, because I mean, they are young, they're only in sixth grade. So that's like how I kind of related fascism to them. I mean, when they don't have that big background.
Matt, what about you? I mean, introducing topics like, again, our history textbooks in this country are often lacking in the full story of the United States, and that can include our history of white supremacy. So I'm wondering how you incorporate those conversations. Maybe it's an introduction of these terms for the first time to high school students, or maybe it's a deepening of their understanding of these concepts.
Yes. I mean, you know, what we say is that we know that classrooms are the front line of democracy and that the future of democracy will be won or lost in the classroom. And so what that means is that I think we had some hard conversations as teachers, you know, over the summer. You know, we you know, kind of agreed that, you know, we know that George Floyd died with a knee on his neck, but it got there under the weight of our apathy. And so what we need to do is completely rewrite the curriculum. We can't just add a lesson about George Floyd or add a lesson about the Capitol. What we need to do is go from the foundation, right? How can we understand what happened to George Floyd without understanding the redlining of our cities, without understanding the continued racial segregation in our public school system, a school system that remains about as segregated as it was in 1980. And in many parts of the country is actually continuing to further segregate. And so we want to build the foundation upon which we can have the conversations that we need to have. I don't believe that we can talk about Black Lives Matter until we talk about, for example, the origin of whiteness itself. Where does this come from and what does it do to us? And so I think those are the foundation is what we're building in order to be able to have conversations about what's happening today.
Brenton, what about parents? You mentioned having students that come from very diverse backgrounds, very diverse political backgrounds, at least from their parents' perspective. Are parents saying, hey, we don't want our kids to talk about that, or we're not interested in them learning about that, or the opposite, teach them more about this?
So far, I haven't had a lot of parents reach out about it, actually. And that's like... In my school, I feel like we have to not toe a line, but also like I'm trying to bring as much information to them as possible and have them critically think about what's going on in a time like this. Most parents have not reached out to me or told me, don't teach them this or teach them that. So I try to teach them as much as possible unless I hear otherwise. But I think that I just keep going. I want them to get as much information as they can, especially in a time like this. It's so important that they're getting the right information and being able to find this information in the right places. I mean, being in a classroom, I think that as teachers, it is our job to make sure that these students, that they're able to find the right information and are not being pushed into disinformation. And if parents, like, I haven't had very many parents, like I said, say anything about this, but... I'm just trying to give them all the facts that I can at this moment.
Matt, we talked a lot about the mental health effects of this pandemic now that we're a year into it, and it looks like it's going to be a while before we reach the capacity of having enough people vaccinated to really make a difference to go back to something, quote unquote, normal. Are your students feeling the weight of history and also the weight of this pandemic right now? Does that that has to add to the stress? And of course, the educators themselves.
Yeah. I mean, to be blunt, I think a lot of my kids are really struggling, both with the anxiety from the pandemic and also just sort of the changes that's kind of underway. We have a theme in my class in the book The Fire Next Time by James Baldwin. There's a quote where he says, to accept one's past is not the same thing as drowning in it. And so we find ways to look clearly at who America has been and what we've been without drowning in that. And so we don't let despair sort of take over. We understand that our generation is sort of the next generation whose job it is to help realize the democracy. And so in that sense, I try to sort of restore a sense of purpose to the students so that they don't just sort of like drown in the weight of what's happening.
Matt, that's a really interesting point that you're raising there. And Brenton, I'm wondering how you see that.
A lot of my students, they're thinking about vaccines and they have hopeful for the future. But I have a lot of students in my classroom who also are dealing with deaths in the family because of coronavirus. I have several students that I've talked to over just winter break who their grandparents died, their uncle died. I had one girl who she got coronavirus and then it spread throughout her family. And because of that, her grandfather died. And so there is sadness around here, and they're also dealing with so much more outside of school. And my job, I feel like right now, is to create a safe space for them when they come into the classroom and provide them a voice in here. It's just, we're in a time that we've never, in such a time that we've never seen before. And so just creating that safe space, being able to talk about the difficult things. And this also comes to, you have to know your students. Knowing each individual student is probably the key thing, because not every single student learns the same, or you can talk to them the same way. And that's the one thing that I've found, especially in such a difficult time right now, not every single conversation is the same. And you just have to be understanding and listen. And a lot of these kids are just going through a really rough time right now.
Brenton Cobb is a sixth grade history teacher in Fort Worth, Texas, and Matt Bachenfeld is a social studies teacher at Fishers High School in Fishers, Indiana. Brenton, Matt, thanks to you both for joining me.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
My name is Keith Harris, and I teach European and United States history, grades 9 through 12, at a private high school in Los Angeles. When I speak to my students about the events at the Capitol on January 6th, I remind them that our democracy depends on the peaceful transfer of power. It's part of our national identity that was put in place by none other than George Washington. My students have asked, then, how we come back together as a nation after something like this. My answer is through justice. Those who are responsible must be held accountable. Then we can unify. The nation witnessed the results of a hasty reconciliation in the wake of the Civil War, which gave us nearly 100 years of Jim Crow segregation, curtailing the citizenship rights of millions of Americans, and ideological animosity that in many ways is still with us. Perhaps we can learn our lessons from the past and then carve out a just future.
Hi, my name is Brian Sheehy. I'm the History Department Coordinator at North Andover High, which is about 30 minutes north of Boston. I teach AP European History, AP US History, Sports in American Culture, and Sports of the Past. I think that especially with the storming of the Capitol, it was important for me as a teacher to go in the following day and just kind of understand where my students' heads were at and help them process. I mean, there's so many things that our students have to process through this pandemic that I thought it was important just to listen and see what they had questions about and see how they felt. Young people really are much more tuned in than I think we give them credit for, and much more in tune with current events than maybe I was when I was their age. It's really a great thing to see as an educator, to see young people really taking an interest in wanting to initiate change. And I hope that continues.
That's all we have for you today, folks. And thank you, as always, for spending part of your day with us. And of course, if you have any thoughts or ideas for the show, send us a tweet at The Takeaway. I'm at Tanzina Vega. But we also take your voice memos. You can record them on your phone and email them to takeawaycallers@gmail.com. Or you can call us at 877-8MYTAKE. That's 877 877- 869-8253 and leave us your takes there. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway, and we'll see you tomorrow.